things clearly. And so that's what we're doing. See, Napoleon Bonaparte saw that Jesus was more than a man. But I want to say to you, he didn't see clearly. And I certainly didn't see clearly till the cataracts were fixed. But took on the Bible. Well, that's the point, I take it, of remembering what happened in chapter 8, verse 22 of Mark's Gospel, where we come across the blind man of Bethesda. It's very strange, this one, because Jesus generally says, be healed, and they're healed. But on this occasion, he did the spitting and put it on his eyes. And generally, when Jesus says, stretch out your arm, it's stretched out and it's fixed. But this time, no. He could see, but he still couldn't understand. He couldn't know what it was he was looking at. Men walking around like trees didn't make sense. And I take it that this paragraph, this event, was put here in the Mark's Gospel at this place because it introduces to us the disciples who could now see but couldn't see clearly. See, up until now in Mark's Gospel, chapter 1 through to chapter 8, the fundamental question of the Gospel is, who is Jesus? And the demonic, unclean spirits, they know who he is, but they're not allowed to tell. But everybody else, who is this man that feeds the multitude? Who is this man who walks on water? Who is this man who is able to cure and heal people with a touch of the word? They keep saying, who is he? Who is he? But yet we're not told. Well, we are. We're told in chapter 1, verse 1. But the people in the events weren't told. And 8:27 is the turning point, the pivot of the whole gospel. When Jesus went with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, that's right up in the north, just outside of really Galilee and Jewish centres. And on the way, he asked his disciples, who do people say I am? Now they give the ancient answers that, some say you're John the Baptist, come back from the dead. Herod had killed John, and Herod was spooked by all the miracles happening in this movement that seemed to be still alive. Some say you're John the Baptist. Others say you're Elijah, because the last chapter of the Old Testament says that before the kingdom comes, Elijah will appear. And so, well, John the Baptist looked like Elijah, got the same kind of sartorial elegance, a leather belt and hair, hairy coat. You hope he had some more than just leather belt and hair, but that's what it says about him. And so he looked like Elijah. And others say, well, look, I don't know who he is, but he's certainly a prophet. There, though, the ancient answers. You know, if we do a little survey out at the main street here tomorrow and just go up and down asking people, who do you think Jesus is? I guarantee no one will say John the Baptist, no one will say Elijah, although some people will say a prophet. They're ancient world answers. What are the modern world answers? Just take a moment, tell the person next to you, which answers would you be expecting out in the main street, Pacific Highway out there? What answers would you expect if we were going down asking? Okay, that's enough. Let's pick up a few. Just single words so we get out here. Yes, from over here. Not real.
Dead man.
Sorry?
Dead man.
Dead man.
Teacher.
Teacher.
Good guy.
Good guy.
Historical figure.
Example. Sorry?
Example.
Example, okay. There'd be all kinds of things that people would say today. Actually, when we've done tests on the university campuses about that, it's surprising a lot of them give very positive answers. You'd be surprised how many people say God. If you come from a Greek Orthodox background, from a Catholic background, you'd say God. Even though you may not understand what God means and what it would mean to you, etc. And lots say a prophet, lots say a teacher, lots say good men. But then we also get these negative ones that you are expecting. Dear friends, lift your optimism. Push down your pessimism. You will get them saying, oh, he's a fake, he was a phony. That does happen in a minority of cases. However, there are all kinds of answers, you see. But Jesus in verse 29 changes the question. But you, who do you say that I am? The you is emphatic in the Greek. Who do you say that I am? It's a different kind of question. So the first question is academic. The second question is existential. It tells you more about you than it does about Jesus. See, if I was asked you, who did Australia vote for? Or what did Australia vote for at the referendum a year or so ago? Well, 60% voted no, 40% voted yes. If I say to you, how did you vote? Your answer would be, none of your business. It's a secret ballot. I don't have to tell you, because you see, in telling me how you voted, you're telling me nothing about Australia, nothing about the election, their vote or the referendum. You're telling me something about you, aren't you? That's why it's rude for me to ask, how did you vote? Whereas it's not rude at all to say, how did Australia vote? That's just objective. So who do people say that I am? Well, this. Who do you say that I am? Now I'm going to find out something about you. I'm not finding anything about Jesus now, but about you. And Peter's answer is, you are the Christ. At last, someone said it. The word Christ means the Messiah, the anointed one, the King of Israel, David's son, the one who's going to come and rule the world forever. Psalm 2, it's the great psalm of David. All the nations of the world, they gather against God and against his anointed, and God says, you are my son. Ask of me and I will give the nations to you. And he warns, the psalmist says to the nations, kiss the son while you can, lest he comes and in anger. You see, here is the judge of the universe. He's the king of the world. This is the anointed one. This is the Christ, the Messiah. And Jesus agrees with him. Jesus hardly ever calls himself God. He hardly ever calls himself the Messiah. But he accepts the title and says, don't tell anybody. He keeps the secret of the Messiah throughout Mark's gospel, right up until the end. Don't tell anybody. Why? Why does Jesus want to keep it a secret? Well, what about you? See, the Christ is Peter's answer. Well, that's good. That's great. And it's the right answer. That's good. Jesus accepts it. That's good. But what about you? Who do you think Jesus is? I'm not asking you personally, but I am asking you personally. From here on in this talk and the coming talks in the next day or so, this is the fundamental. Who do you think Jesus is? Now, there's all kinds of answers people give, but frankly, they all come under one of four headings. And the easy way of putting it is they all come under the letter L. Either he's a liar or a lunatic or a legend or the Lord. There's the options. He's a liar. He claims to be the Christ when he's not. He's a lunatic. He thinks he's God. Well, most people who think they're God, we think are lunatics. Or he's a legend. You know, that something happened back then, but it's got bigger and bigger and better, and really, he didn't think this of himself. All kinds of different answers can be fitted under those three headings. But if none of those headings fit, then the other alternative is he's the Lord. Lords don't mean much to us today, do they? They sit in the House of Lords in Britain, and they have no direct control over the affairs of Australia. And anyway, what do they do? Actually, they're important. Right at the moment, they're discussing euthanasia legislation, and they actually do have an important role, but that's another story. But lords don't have... But the word lord means a slave owner, a master, a ruler. You know, if you're a lord in the ancient Roman Empire and you didn't have any slaves, you weren't much of a lord. Who are you lord over if you haven't got a slave? But remember, most people were slaves. I mean, we got lots of slaves in our kitchen. You know, we've got a microwave slave, we've got a stove slave, we've got a dishwasher slave, we've got an iron slave. We've got all these slaves, you see. We've replaced humans with our technology, you know, and soon our technology is going to replace us as well. But there's the slavery of the ancient world was humans doing all these many, many tasks. And the Lord was the master, the ruler, the owner. That's what the Lord was. Now, the rest of this, the talk tonight and this week is going to answer really the question of what does it mean to be the Lord? What's that mean? If you go down lunatic, well, that's pretty clear what you should do. Have nothing to do with Jesus. If he's a liar, well, then you certainly shouldn't. You know, put him in the category used car salesman, real estate salesman, you know, politician, journalist. He's just one of them, right? If he's the legend, well, then again, you just ignore him. But if he's the Lord, well, that actually has implications for life. So what does it mean to be the Lord? And it starts with a question, why did Jesus come? That's where we go to, you see. Because verse 31, once he's been told who he is and the disciples now know who he is and confess who he is, once that happens, then he began. Notice how it says there in verse 31? He began to teach them something new, something you won't find in chapters 1 to 8, but you find in chapters 9 to 16. He began to teach them something extraordinary. You see, he began to teach them some new information. He says, the Son of Man. He doesn't use the word Christ about himself. He uses the phrase, Son of Man. That's his consistent phrase. He's the only person who uses it, and he always uses it of himself. What does it mean? Well, it could just emphasize his humanity. The book of Ezekiel uses the book like that. Or it could mean one. In Aramaic, it's the third person, impersonal, singular, one. You know, one can own corgis if one was a queen. You know, one would speak in this strange way about oneself because one doesn't want to impress. It's just one. And it can mean that. Or it could mean Daniel 7. For in Daniel 7, there's a great image of, great picture, a great vision of the judgment day. And I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. At the end of the world, in the judgment day, at the end of the universe, there is this Son of Man. And this Son of Man has dominion and glory and kingdom. But notice his kingdom is across all people, all nations, all languages. And not only is it across everything, it's forever. It's an everlasting dominion that will not be destroyed. The ruler over everything forever. That's the one the Son of Man is going to be. And when Jesus is standing in front of them saying, now the Son of Man, I guarantee they weren't thinking of Daniel 7. They were thinking, he does talk funny, doesn't he? Talking about himself like one. But it's just an odd thing we remember. He used to say that a lot about the Son of Man. He is the Christ, yes, but he's going to rule the world. But he's not going to rule the world in the age to come. He's not the judge of all the world. He's just the king now, the king in Israel. Here's the first lesson about lordship. It's his new teaching about suffering. Because the Son of Man, he says, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And that is absolutely shocking news. It's a prediction of the future that they cannot come to terms with. He's going to die. He's going to be rejected. He's going to be executed. It cannot be. You're the Christ. You're the King. You're the ruler. How can you be executed, rejected? He said, but he said, in 3 days rise again. Yes, they didn't understand that at all. See, they were thinking of the Christ, not the Son of Man. They were thinking of the world ruler, not the world ruler. And the resurrection for them meant the judgment at the end of the world. And so it was a way of saying, and he's going to go to heaven. We use that language. They use the language in the resurrection. He will go to life. Because they believed in the resurrection. The Sadducees didn't. That's why they're sad, you see. But the Pharisees, they believed it. And Jesus taught it. That there is going to be a resurrection. And that's what happens. That's when you go into the next life. And so the resurrection, they didn't think for a moment that meant he was going to return to life here. They just meant he's going to be killed and go to heaven. So the resurrection 3 days later, they wouldn't have heard that. I'm sure they didn't. What they did hear was, he's going to be killed. Hey, I've given up my father's fishing business. I've been walking around the whole of Palestine with this man for the last however many months or maybe even a year by this stage of the game. I've seen fantastic things, you know, astonishing things. I've been through great things with him. And now when I finally acknowledge, yes, he's the king, he's going to conquer the Romans, he's going to conquer the Greeks, he's going to conquer the Persians, he's going to set up Israel as it really should be. This is the one. And he says, yes, I'm going up to Jerusalem to be killed. Well, I might as well go back fishing. Why did I ever leave the fishing nets if that's the case? This is an appalling idea. And so Peter immediately rejects him and rebukes him. And here's second lesson on lordship. Jesus will rule his way, not your way. He really is the Lord. I mean, Peter is a bit thick. That's why we all like him. You know, he opens his mouth to change his feet. If you're a talkative person, as I am, Peter is a great patron saint, you know, because you just make so many mistakes. My mother used to say that I could talk under wet cement, which Helen says is not true. She said it could be dry. So if you're a person who talks a lot, you're always saying the wrong thing. You know, you're always putting your foot in it one way or another. And Peter is a classic in that. You are the Christ. And let me tell you how to be a Christ, because clearly you don't know how to do it, do you? I mean, what an idiot to try and advise the Christ on how to be the Christ. But what the Christ was saying about being killed, well, he needed some lessons. Needed early, you know, go back to 101 Christ learning properly. But notice how Jesus won't have anything to do with Peter's rebuke, verse 33. Get behind me, Peter. Satan. You're not on the side of God, you're on the side of man. You're on the side of the evil one. See, Jesus hears in the voice of Peter Satan's temptations in the wilderness. Don't go the way of the cross. Turn the stones into bread. Jump off the top of the temple and let people see a great miracle. Bow down and worship me. Don't go the cross. Don't go the cross. Don't go the cross. Don't go the cross. And then the third lordship lesson is spelled out by Jesus. When he calls the crowds to him together with the disciples, and we read in verse 34, what does Jesus require? Verse 34, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever will save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel will save it. Anyone So he's calling the crowds. This is not just discipleship teaching now. He calls the crowds to him. And he says, you want to be my followers? You want to follow the Christ? Okay, this is a wonderful thing. Three things you've got to do. Number one, deny yourself. Number two, take up the cross. Number three, follow me. All of which equals lose your life for my sake and the gospel's. Think about that for a moment. Deny. What does it mean, deny yourself? Well, the word deny means say no. If I deny myself an ice cream, I won't have it. I'm never sure what day that is ever likely to happen, but to deny is always say no. To deny an accusation. I saw you steal that kid's ice cream. No, I didn't. I paid him for it. I deny. It's just to say no. Now, what have I got to say no to? An ice cream? No. What I've got to say no to is self. Myself. Everybody lives for themselves. But you can't be a disciple of Jesus and live for yourself. You've got to say no to self. That's dramatic. Take up the cross. I'm not looking. And don't be embarrassed. Just change it. But wearing little crosses of a piece of jewellery really is disgusting. The cross was designed not just as a painful form of execution, but a shameful form of execution and a political statement of the power of Rome and the stupidity of slaves ever revolting against it. Roman citizens could not be crucified because it was beneath the dignity of a Roman citizen. Only the slaves could be crucified. And when you were crucified, you're stuck up at a pole and it would take you 2 or 3 days to die. And all the crowds would gather around. In fact, the crowds gathered around on the way to the cross. Because as you carried your cross out to the place of execution, that's when the crowds could have fun with you. Because you're a dead man walking, you see. And the crowds did make fun of them and jostle them and throw rotten fruit at them because they were going out there to be hoisted up on this stake. And there they would slowly heave themselves to death. And the birds didn't wait till they died before they plucked their eyes out and started taking their skin off them. And what it said was, don't fiddle with Rome. Don't play with Rome. We are in charge. To make jewellery out of it is obscene. You see, Jesus says, declare yourself dead. The crowds will hate you and they'll do to you what they do to a condemned man. Accept your condemnation and come follow me to my execution. You see, it's explained in the next verse, isn't it? You've got to lose your life. In other words, to be one of Jesus' disciples, you've got to drop dead. How to become a Christian? Drop dead. Deny, take up, follow. And that is the reason why you do that. For my sake and the gospel's. Because you see who Jesus is and you know he is the Lord, then you'll, for your Lord's sake, give up yourself completely. Lose all your civil rights, all your personal rights, all yourself for him. And not just for him, but also for his cause, for his message, for his gospel. There's all kinds of people, you see, happy enough to embrace Jesus, but don't want to be embracing gospel ministry. You can't do that. If you have Jesus, you have his gospel. See, you want to be like Jesus. This is a true saying, worthy of all men to be received. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners. So if you want to be like Jesus, and you don't want to go into the world and save sinners, you're not like Jesus. Americans, they're such wonderful people. But, you know, They've got the little wristband around, you know, WWJD. What would Jesus do? One, he wouldn't wear a little band, WWJD. And number two, you never have to ask what would Jesus do, because we know what Jesus did. So I never need to ask the question, what would Jesus do? I just ask, look at what Jesus did. And Jesus did come into the world to save sinners. That's what he did. And so he says, you want to be my disciple? Then lose your life for my sake and the gospel's. You can't have one without the other. So you see, the third lesson of lordship is this total commitment to Jesus and his gospel. Christianity can never be a hobby. You know, I play tennis on Saturday mornings and I watch the kids play on Saturday afternoons. We have a barbecue and then Sunday morning I go to church. Then Sunday afternoon I get ready for the works week. It just kind of fits in with my kind of program of, that's not Jesus. Jesus is saying total commitment. It's not a culture to conserve. You know, our Western civilization is collapsing, and it is, because we've lost our cultural roots, and our cultural roots go back to Christianity, and so therefore we've got to restore kind of a Christian world so that we can have a culture of civilized life that will enable us to retain our wealth, prosperity. It's not MAGA. That's not what it is. So we have Richard Dawkins, the great atheist, who is a cultural Christian. What kind of Christian is a cultural Christian? A pagan, that's what they are. It's not Christian. No. And it's not an institution. Oh, you've got to join up with this church or that church, or as if it's got nothing to do with that. Right? The Bible was read by a Baptist and is now being spoken by an Anglican. Where does that leave you Presbyterians? I mean, as if it matters. I'm sorry. Those are European hangovers that have come with colonisation in Australia. But I know we can argue more than that, but really, it's not about joining an institution. It's about a man and his message. It's about the Lord who came to save the world. But yet, it's something that is very literal. It's not just, oh, okay, theoretically, I follow Jesus. No, no, if I do, it's going to change my career. It's going to change my marriage. It's going to change the way I think and use money. It's going to lead to my imprisonment. It's going to lead to my rejection. Do you see the importance of the question, who do you think Jesus is? I mean, if he's not the Lord, then give your life to lunacy. It doesn't make sense. It's a legend. Doesn't make sense. Liar. Doesn't make sense. But if he is the Lord, then not to give your life to him doesn't make sense. If he is the Son of Man, who is the judge of the living and the dead at the end of the world, then to ignore him is as much folly as to follow a lunatic. So the question of who do you think Jesus is the big question to answer. But once you've got one cataract fixed, you've got the other eye yet. You see, I see, but the men are walking around like trees. He hasn't seen. Not clearly. But notice how the passage goes on to answer the question, why do we do what Jesus requires? I mean, he's already given one answer in verse 35. The only way to save your life is to lose it. It doesn't explain how his cross and his resurrection is going to save you. But now there are three other questions that answer why we do it. What profit? In verse 36. What to give in return? Verse 37. And oh, the shame of verse 38. What is a profit to gain the whole world and lose your soul? It's one of the great questions of the Bible, that one, isn't it? And it's just so true. As you look at the mega rich and see the misery of their lives before their death, and facing the judgment of God. Well, what profit is there in gaining this world? I've held in my hand Olympic gold medals that I didn't win. And when I was given this Olympic gold medal, I was told who won it at the Olympics that I had listened to as a child. And I couldn't remember them. Fame is very short. All the medals that people have, don't remember. You know, when I was a kid, I remembered every medal. When I was a kid, I used to tell you cricket statistics. But when I grew up, I realised that cricket's a game. It's not life. I didn't know that when I was 9 and thought I was playing for Australia in the backyard. Because in the end, I came to understand that that's where cricket is played, in the backyard, on Christmas Day when the parents want to have a sleep after lunch. It's a nothing. But yet, playing for Australia, it's a nothing. I could tell you the names of cricketers who have played for Australia and you say, oh, how good were they? Well, unless you're one of those weirdos like I used to be who reads Wisden and recorded all the details. They're just another name. They're just another name. It doesn't matter how well they did, how high they rise in the markets, how fabulously their academic results got them their professorship, how it's just nothing. What's it gain you to gain the whole world? Or verse 37 turns it, what can you give in return for your soul? And the answer is, of course, nothing. You can't give anything in return for your soul. There's no trade you can do in souls. That's not possible. So the idea that, no, I wouldn't give my life to Christ because whatever you answer then, you'll see, is stupid, especially when somebody else is telling it to you. When it's your own thing, you might think it's reasonable. But when you listen to other people, it's never reasonable. I spoke to a big fellow, a lovely bloke. His mother was a Christian and he wanted to get married, but he wanted to marry a Christian wife because he knew Christian women were the best women to have as wives. But he couldn't because he wasn't a Christian. And so he came to church and we shared the gospel with him and he saw the truth of it all. And I said, then give your life to Christ. He said, I can't. He was a big, burly fella. Worked on the lines, the telegraph lines, etc. And he said, no, I can't. I said, why not? He said, well, every Thursday night we go to the pub after work and get drunk. He said, I couldn't explain to those blokes that I wasn't going to get drunk on a Thursday night anymore. For the sake of getting drunk on a Thursday night? You've got to think that's stupid, haven't you? He didn't. He said he was afraid to take up the cross. He was afraid of the persecution. The persecution. Bunch of galahs laughing at you. That's persecution. But he wouldn't. It's a bloke at school. It's a very old story. Bloke at school we shared the gospel with, and he saw the truth of it. And we said, well, then become a Christian. He said, no, I can't. Got my eye on this girl. Been inviting her out. She's finally agreed to go out with me. She's just agreed to be my girlfriend. You know, he was all of 16, 17 at the time. She hates Christianity. I couldn't be a Christian. She dropped me immediately. Sake of the girl, excuse me girls, you are very wonderful and you're a lot better than a bunch of bozo idiots getting drunk on a Thursday night, but for the sake of a girl, he chose not to become a Christian. And you know what happened, you can guess what happened, can't you? 3 months later, she dropped him. But how do you turn back to Jesus then? You know, you're my second best Jesus, you're my default option. As best I know, he never did turn back. What does it profit you to gain? What can you give in return for? If Jesus is the Lord, still the same questions, you see. The third one about verse 38 is shame. You're going to be ashamed of Jesus now. Rest assured, he'll be ashamed of you when he returns. It's the trade-off. In our Australian society, standing up as a Christian can actually lead you to considerable shame because you stand on particular moral issues that the society has rejected now. It even goes further. Our government has now passed legislation that makes Christian prayer illegal in certain circumstances. I'm still going to do it. I'm not going to be ashamed of Jesus. Jesus went to the cross. What's the big deal going to Long Bay Jail? Yeah, but they feed you there. So you still have the same questions today. Satan uses two things: lies, accusations, and persecution, seduction. Lies and accusations, you see, he is a liar and an accuser. That's what the word Satan means, the accuser. He accuses you before God. He accuses God before you. How? Well, he says, you couldn't get to heaven. You know, given what you've done, given the lies you've told, given the lusts that you've had, given the envy, given the rivalry, given the love, given what you have done, you're not able to go to heaven. You see, that's a terrible lie. Because all sins are forgivable. And it's a terrible lie against God, because it says God's not gracious and forgiving, generous. God has not sent his son to die for you. The cross answers all the lies and all the accusations. But the second way Satan actually uses is persecution or seduction. Persecution, well, I've told you about that, but seduction's the big one in Australia. We are so wealthy. We have so much pleasure and freedom and independence that we live for this world, not the next. There's so much of paradise here in Australia that we can't imagine it could be better somewhere else. We're just walking down here this evening in the bay and the sunshine, and we had a whole set of beautiful pink clouds late this afternoon. I don't know if you went out and saw them, but it was just magnificent. It's all here already. What? We've got health. Did you know between 1970 and today, we have added 10 years to life expectancy? In the 1970s, you died on average at 72. Today, you die on average at 82. This is unbelievable wealth. Do you know that Australia produces 7 times more food than we consume? We are living in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, in one of the wealthiest times in history. And we have such opportunities to grow in our own personal wealth as we like. And so we're too busy for God. So, let's capture what I said. Who do you think Jesus is? If your answer is the Lord, well, there are 3 lessons of Lordship. I've started with this tonight. 1, he's the Lord by suffering the loss of all things in his death. 2, he's the Lord his way, not your way. Don't tell Jesus how to do his job. Don't say, well, if I was God, I would. You're not God, so stop that stupid stuff, right? He comes to be the Lord his way. 3, He requires then total commitment of all your life to him and his gospel. But friends, this is just what it is to be a Christian. If anyone would come after me, let him. This is the invitation for all people, whoever. And before we go through this week of thinking, how do we make progress in our Christian lives and ministry? Let's just be very clear that that's what our life is. That we actually are a Christian like this. How? Well, it's by prayer. That's our. And so the prayer is up there behind me, I presume. But it's the prayer you pray to become a Christian. But whereas Mark's gospel says take up your cross, Luke's gospel says take up your cross daily. What I pray to become a Christian is what I can pray every day as a Christian. And so I want us to close with this prayer. You'll notice it has three elements to it. The first element's all about me. I. But it's all negative. I know I'm not worthy to be accepted. I don't deserve your gift of. I am guilty. I need forgiveness. It's all negative. Second part of it, the second paragraph of it, is all thanking. Thanking God for sending his son to die for us. Thanking God that his son rose to give us new life. The third paragraph is the prayer of the prayer. That's the bit where you're asking. What are you asking? Please forgive me. Well, I need forgiveness, and Jesus died for my forgiveness, so please forgive me. And secondly, please change me. Yes, I can't go on living like the first paragraph. And Jesus has risen from the dead to give me new life, so please change me. In what way? That I may live with Jesus as my Lord, my ruler, my owner. Deny myself, take up the cross, follow him. Well, how about we pray it together and pray it out loud, shall we? Dear God, I know that I'm not worthy to be accepted by you. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you. I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your son to die for me, that I may be forgiven. Thank you that he rose from the dead to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me, that I may live with Jesus as my Lord. Amen. Friends, if that is your first time you really prayed like that, let me assure you, you will be forgiven. How do I know? It's written in the very blood of Jesus. And you will be changed. How do I know? Because Jesus isn't dead. He's risen to rule the world. But if it is the first time you've prayed it, or first time you've come back for a long time, then talk to somebody about it. If you can't find anybody else, talk to me about it. All you need to say is, I prayed that prayer tonight in a new way. That's the opening statement. And if the person can't pick that up and help you, then go find someone else in this room too. And take them with you.